Thank you all for being here tonight, whether you're online or in person. It's very strange to do both, and I'm no longer on mute, as we've all been saying for the past year or so. So the longer title of my talk, I got asked to give a title of that. Equanimity. I couldn't think of much. But the longer title that I came up with since then is Equanimity, Finding Balance in a Broken World, Staying Steady Through the Storm. So early on in his teaching, the Buddha allegedly, and I think a lot of things from the Buddha are alleged, but described life as 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows. And in the world, I know for me, each day seems to bring at least another 10,000 of each, right? Especially in the world today, especially in the world at work, especially in the world in our relationships. And the Buddha, of course, also famously reminded us of something else, that there's a lot of suffering in this world and that life itself is pretty stressful. And also that it's unpredictable. And equanimity is about learning to abide with and be with that unpredictability in life. And one of my favorite fake Buddha quotes, I think there's actually an account even online that's just got like all the fake Buddha quotes, but some of them are really good, and I don't know whether this one's real or not, but that change or uncertainty is the only constant in this world. I don't know who said it or not, but I found this to be very helpful in my own life. And I think to me, what Buddhism, what the Dharma teaches us also is that this idea that change is a certainty, and uncertainty is always going to be there, that these can contribute to our suffering. If we let ourselves get whipped around by all this change, whiplash, kind of emotionally and all these other ways, or it can be the touchstone of our growth, of our wisdom. And to me, that's also so much of the story of the Buddha's life and everything that he taught, was experiencing and encountering suffering. And then, okay, how do I transform this not into more bitterness or into more cynicism or more hopelessness and helplessness, but into how can I transform the suffering that I'm seeing in others? How can I transform the suffering that I'm feeling in myself into wisdom, into more compassion in this world? But change is hard. Change is hard for all of us. It continues to be hard for all of us. We've had a lot of changes recently. I mean, even just being here looks different with masks on and a smaller group, and then also a screen in the background here, right? Things change. Most of us don't really like change. My family legend in my life was, or in my family, was when I was two, the refrigerator broke or something. And so my parents got a new refrigerator, and I was like wailing unconsolably as the refrigerator people wheeled away the old refrigerator and we got a new one, right? It's hard. I see this in my own kids, the hardness of change. And I still feel this even many years later than being 2 years old, right? I don't want to try that new food. I don't want to be in this world online. I don't want to do this. I don't want to do that. You can't make me, right? I don't love it when things change. A lot of us don't. And so how do we deal with all this change? How do we abide, which is kind of the Dharma word that we hear a lot, all these pains and all these joys of life, not getting swept up in them, expecting that they'll last forever, not turning our backs on them and ignoring them? And also, how do we, I think, more and more about relational Buddhism and the importance of being in the world and what karma really is, which is that as we think and act, as we speak and act, as the Buddha says in the Dhammapada, right, so our world becomes. What we embody then actually does karmically ripple out to other people. So how do I cultivate equanimity in myself so that I can then help others with this as well? So to me, part of what equanimity is it is some degree of having comfort with this change, with this unpredictability in the world. And also it's about not making these assumptions that just because things are like this now, that they're going to be like this forever either, right? We often get attached to these certain ideas. This is how it is now, so this is how it's going to be forever, right? Or this is how it should be, or this is how I like it to be, so I want it to be like this, or that it's always going to be good, or that it's always going to be bad, or that it's always going to be chaotic, or something like this. And what I know in my day job as a psychologist, in terms of attempting to study the brain, attempting to study the mind, which so many different professions, including spiritual folks, have tried to do for millennia, is that our brains, they decide to kind of make things permanent. Like we think, you know, just because it's like this now, we decided it is going to be like this forever. Right? The pain of this breakup, if that's maybe what we're going through or been through, or the sadness of this loss, that's going to be like this forever. Or the traffic in Cambridge, getting over here in traffic. Right? The traffic is going to be like this forever in Cambridge. Well, it probably won't be at 9 o'clock tonight. Right? It will actually change. But if I get stuck in that story, if I get attached to that story, what do we know about attachment from the Dharma? Right? Attachment creates more suffering in us. And it's also not necessarily accurate, that story we tell. Right? But we all have variations on this story. Right? The exhaustion of graduate school will never end. The unpleasantness of these chemo treatments, or even positive things, this beautiful day, you know, hopefully it will never end, or this rainy day, or this addiction will never end, or this political situation will never end, this pandemic will never end. We start to get attached to this is the story of how it will be. Right? Some days it's big, it's the globe, it's politics. Some days it's work, some days it's small, some days it's, you know, this little situation at work is so important, it's never going to change. Right? But they do all eventually change. But our brains decide that how it's like now is how it's going to be in the future. And I think we all have these stories. And so, again, you know, therapist, day job, it is a bit like a Rorschach, right? What for you is that condition that you think it's like this now? And so it's always going to be like this. So just reflecting a little bit on that, what's the story you keep telling yourself that this will never change? Because it actually will change. A good friend of mine has a tattoo on it, and it just says, right now it's like this. He's a Buddhist guy. And I always love that, just that reminder. I don't know if I need a tattoo, or maybe I do because I forget it, so it's maybe good to have more permanent, right? But right now, it's like this. That doesn't mean that it's going to be like that tomorrow. It might, because I think we always have to figure maybe it will, right? Can we hold all of this at once? It might be like that tomorrow, but it doesn't have to be, right? So learning to abide, to be with that, right? This is equanimity. When I first heard this, or I think when I was younger and saw what I thought were the cool Buddhists or the cool kind of people that looked sort of Buddhist or Buddhish, right? It looked like this, like, oh yeah, no worries, man. Like, let it roll off you, right? And we all probably know folks who mistake that attitude of equanimity for something like passivity or something like indifference. Right? And it's really important that we not mistake this attitude of equanimity for passivity or for indifference. In fact, these are often described as the near enemies of equanimity, or something like passivity. I don't have to do anything, right? I don't want to do anything. Right? Why bother? Right? Why recycle? The oceans are full of microplastics anyway. Why vote? It's just one vote. It doesn't matter. Why be kind, right? No one else is these days, right? That's not equanimity. That's not radical acceptance. That's not what this is about. It's about just hiding in our meditation centers or hiding on our cushion at home. It's about, actually, it is about taking action in the world, but taking skillful action. So this idea of equanimity is not indifference. That's a near enemy. It's a radical acceptance, and it's also a radical not knowing. And it's also not contributing to more unpredictability and more chaos in the world either, right? But abiding with it, being with it when we can. It's about when we are able to have some degree of acceptance, not passivity, but active, radical acceptance, right? That also helps us to see a little bit more clearly the causes of this, the conditions under which these different challenges in the world arise, and see the interdependence of things. It also helps us to not take it quite so personally when things aren't going our way. It's just how it is. The traffic is just how it is. It's not about me that person cut me off. Just like it's not about me that it rained or my flight got delayed yesterday or, you know, whatever these things might be. It's letting go a little bit of the attempt to control, the illusion of control. But it's also still getting curious about, I can both renounce control and attempting to control, right? I can try. I can talk about renouncing control, but also how do I take skillful action in this world, but also without exhausting myself by constantly taking action? How do I keep all of this alive too? Embrace all of this when there's so much pain in this world. Right? It's sort of finding, holding all of it, to me, is also what equanimity is about. Or we think about something like the Bodhisattva vow, right? Suffering is endless, right? I vow to end it all, right? That's impossible, right? But is it, right? What if I still walk into the world? What if I still walk into situations with that intention? Even if in some sense it might be impossible, I can still go with that intention. Beings are endless. I vow to liberate them all. How do I hold all these contradictions? How do I hold all these tensions in the world? And in this world, I think equanimity, it's also inextricably linked with so many other concepts in the Dharma, with compassion, with loving kindness, with wisdom, being able to hold all of this. And yet, also, these both go together. They overlap, and they don't overlap at sometimes, too. We can have equanimity without compassion, like when we feel burned out and the empathy just shuts off. We get that kind of case of the, you know, the screw it, the F it, or we dismiss other concerns as, right, petty or self-centered, right? Or as a therapist, again, my day job, right? Equanimity without compassion. All right, someone comes into my office, right, with a breakup or a loss or a disappointment. And if I lean in with, well, you know, that's, you know, you got attached, right? You're not supposed to get attached, right? What kind of Dharma teacher is that? Oh, you got attached. That's your problem. That's why you're suffering. It's like, well, as humans, we're supposed to get attached. We're supposed to experience all those joys of connection, of love, of attachment, right? So if I respond with just, you know, that, you know, no compassion, but just the problem is your attachment, doesn't help that person. Doesn't help me have them come back to my office the next week to pay my office rent, right? It doesn't really help anybody. But, you know, when we can take the big picture and we can see, you know, breakups are a part of life. Loss is a part of life. Sickness, aging, and death. These are painful, but they are part of life. They don't tell us. The lesson of those from the Buddha is not that we don't make connections, that we don't relate to others, that we avoid any attachments to others or avoid relationships. That there's some wisdom to be found in the pain of and the attachment to these things and the fact of, right, these heavenly messengers of aging, illness, and death, that when we lean in and explore it, get curious about it, bring a mindful, compassionate awareness to these, then more wisdom starts to be generated, more compassion starts to be generated, right? And again, then that ripples out. When I learn to experience the pain of life, right, then I can share that wisdom with others, and then they can experience their version of that. They can share that with others. These things really ripple out. Again, to me, that's what karma is. That's what this is about. So learning to hold all of that, I think, is important too. And we can have compassion, or what looks like compassion, without equanimity or without wisdom. We can think about that kind of fool's compassion, that fool's equanimity or that doormat kind of compassion. We might call this enabling or responding to someone's immediate wants over their long-term needs or even our own because of our intolerance of discomfort, our intolerance of unpredictability, right? And I think a lot of us who hang out in places like this, we're helpers, we're healers, we like other people to feel good. It's often, I mean, that's why I do the work that I do. I find it really hard to tolerate other people being uncomfortable, other people being sad. I want to make it better for them, right? And so I think through equanimity and through these practices that we learn in places like this, we learn how to tolerate someone else being somewhat uncomfortable, someone else being inconvenienced, someone else being in pain without doing that, you know, immediately trying to gratify or do that people-pleasing thing to keep people, you know, keep everyone kind of in balance and in check and emotionally feeling like, oh, they must be happy or we have to do this for them. A friend of mine put it this way. He said something like, compassion with equanimity means I want you to be happy, but I don't need you to be happy in order for me to be okay. I want you to be happy, but I don't need you to be happy in order for me to be okay. And we can take that into our relationships, our intimate relationships, our family relationships, our work relationships. We start to shift and interact with the world in a very different way. So equanimity is that radical not knowing, not taking everything so personally, not feeling like we have to take action, unskillful action, about every challenge that we encounter in the world, which there's plenty of in this world. And we do this in our own meditation practice. We recognize strong, difficult emotions in ourselves, and we recognize these hopefully in others as they arise, just like the weather, right? Emotions come, emotions go. We learn how to name these in our sitting practice. Anger is here, sadness is here. That idea of naming it to tame it, which we know actually does happen when we're able to name our emotion in practice, actually activates the prefrontal cortex part of the brain, and that actually takes the blood out of the more big emotional, impulsive parts of the brain. So naming, recognizing our emotions in this way, or when we're getting pulled in these different directions, that brings more equanimity, it brings more peace, it brings more balance. It helps us see clearly with what the skillful action might be. And a lot of us know like the Rumi, the guest house poem, right? Like just inviting them in, the sadness, the sorrows, the joys of life. And just naming them, welcoming them. I was thinking about a friend of mine, I was in Ireland a few years ago teaching with a friend of mine who's a wonderful mindfulness teacher. And she was telling me in the Irish language, they don't say, the indigenous Irish language of Gaelic, Irish Gaelic, they don't say like, I'm sad, I'm angry. They say, anger is on me, sadness is on me. And I don't know that much about languages, but even just this gives us a bit of distance. Okay, it's here. Just like it's raining outside. Doesn't mean it's raining on me. Right? I don't have to take it personally. It's a little bit of more helpful to get that distance sometimes from our emotions. So I found this helpful to note in myself the emotions that are arising and to see in others that their emotions are arising, to not always take that personally, but understand what are the conditions under which these emotions arise. And then maybe what can I do? Can I pause, then respond more skillfully? It's hopefully made me a better father, maybe a better therapist, maybe a better friend, maybe a better husband, all of these kinds of things. So when we can see the challenging emotions or the challenges in the world, when we can be with them, be with that discomfort, be with that uncertainty, we start to open ourselves to a deeper engagement with life. We can start to embody a bit more balance and stability in the face of all of the uncertainty, all of the change that's going to be here. And that equanimity helps us to be a stable person, again, for others in our lives. which again hopefully makes the world a better place, as other people can feel safe around us, feel comfortable around us, feel more compassion for others and the safety of our presence, feel more compassion for themselves and the safety of our presence, and create just more, again, physical, psychological, spiritual safety and development in this world. So that as we speak and act, so our world continues to become, expanding outward. So equanimity, it's said to keep us on the right track, kind of moving forward through life toward maybe we call it enlightenment or happiness or whatever we're kind of moving toward in life. And we're always getting blown off course. And so some of us have maybe heard of this concept of the 8 worldly winds. And I always like this metaphor of these different winds that it's like we're in a boat and they're pushing us one direction or they're pushing us another direction, and we try to stay on course, whatever that course is for us. Which maybe we think about more deeply. What are our values, right? How do I want to live my values? How do I want to look back on my life, right? And then we can think from the present. How do I keep moving forward? But these winds blow us, they blow us off course. So what are they? There's fame and disrepute. Some call this praise and blame. There's gain and loss, which we've all presumably experienced as well. These also blow us off course, again, because our brains start to tell us, oh, it's gain now, it's always going to be gain in the stock market, or it's loss now, it's always going to be loss of friendships, everyone's going to abandon me. Right? We keep telling ourselves these stories. We get attached to these stories, especially when we're emotional. Right? Praise and blame, gain and loss, success and failure. It's only going to be promotions from here on out. Or it's only going to be getting fired again. Why do I even bother getting a new job, right? Or joy and sorrow, the 10,000 joys, the 10,000 sorrows. We get attached to all of these. We want more of these. We crave more of these. We're greedy for some of these, and we have aversion to those other ones. And so we don't, you know, we overcorrect when we're trying to steer that boat. Right? But equanimity, it's like, to me, I think it's like ballast in the bottom of the boat that keeps it a little bit more steady in the storm, and the ballast needs to be heavy, and it needs to be spread wide, and it needs to be deep as well. Right? But these are the winds that we've experienced. We've probably experienced other ones too. Right? So thinking about these and how then different experiences have impacted us. Right? That, you know, when we've had privilege, for example, we think all these successes, we take that personally. It must be about that, about me, that everything's going so well. Or maybe it's not actually part of that, it's that I'm a white cisgender male, right? Maybe it actually is more complicated. It's not that. It is somewhat situational, the successes that I've had. Or also these other things that start to become permanent, or permanent perceptions of the world, and for good reason, that again, sort of, as a psychologist thinking about this, right? Those of us who've been through traumatic experiences, everything looks like a danger. That's a great safety mechanism to just keep steering away from danger, but it ends up can end up steering us off course also. Okay, so how do we steer back, but also not overcorrect either? And so this is also how we're wired as humans. Again, neuroscience tells us that we tend to make these stories. We tend to assume how it is now is how it will always be. We project the present into the future. Scientists figured that out, even though the Buddha already figured that out a few thousand years ago. And so we suffer because of this. And we suffer when we're blown about by these 8 worldly winds. And we also suffer when the people that we love, that we care about, that we're attached to are blown about. Right? By praise and blame, by gain and loss, all of these kinds of things. I think a lot about, I started actually writing and studying some of this a lot more deeply about 10 years ago, right before my first son was born. I only have one son, actually, I have a son and daughter. Right before my son was born, my first kid was born, and it was August 2014 that my son was due. And he was late, a few weeks late. And that night, my sister called me to tell me she'd been diagnosed with stage 2 breast cancer, right? Joys and sorrows, right? One day we have it all, a feels like we have it all. The next day we lose that job, we lose that house, that family member, right? One day we're the cool new person at work. We're so excited. Before we know it, right, we're the boring old boss no one listens to anymore. Right? I still feel like I was the cool teenager. Right now, I'm the old-fashioned, uptight parent. I think about my own therapist, right, tells me what a great parent I am. And then my son's therapist, you know, just gave me a very long list of suggestions for how to be a better parent, right? All of these things. So we get attached to things being one way, like one of these eight worldly winds. And it's a setup for suffering because the winds change direction, always changing. Right? Success is great, but it can lead to arrogance. Right? Then we feel like we have more to lose. Right? We want too much praise. Right? Makes us also kind of full of ourselves. And we're always looking for praise everywhere to fill that hole, like that hungry ghost. We over-identify with failure and loss. Right? We assume that we're incompetent. We assume that we'll never be able to do anything. We feel inadequate. Right? We try to push away pain in unhealthy ways. We all do that. How do we remain a bit more even keel? The challenge to me in all of this with the worldly winds is learning not to over-identify with these as they come and go, not to see them as permanent, not to dismiss them either. Right? This will immediately change. Okay, whatever. I don't even have to think about this. I lost the job. I don't have to. Another one will come along, right? That's unrealistic. That's delusion also, right? We dismiss stuff and minimize things in our lives, right? That's that kind of false equanimity. Again, these things do matter, right? But the good news and the bad news is that these are all temporary storms. So none of them will last forever. And I think it's a useful reflection again for each of us of these eight worldly winds. What challenges you the most? What has challenged you the most recently? What do you fear the most? Is it fame? Is it disrepute? Is it gain? Is it loss? And material things and relationships? Is it success? Is it failure? What do those mean? Is it joy? Is it sorrow? Which of these challenges you today? How do you overcorrect? How do you tend to try to steer through those winds? What are the healthy, the not so healthy ways that you have picked, you do pick? To manage fame and disrepute, gain and loss, success and failure, joy and sorrow. Which of these do we fear? Which of these do we grasp onto more of? And how can we also rest a bit in the spaces in between, not getting attached to there's no winds blowing or they don't feel like they're blowing too hard right now, but just enjoy, okay, I'm not feeling so blown off course in this moment. I've been really interested in this concept a little bit out of Eastern philosophy and Buddhism of, in Japanese, it's called ma. It's the space in between things. It's kind of the energy in between things. That's how when we speak, we try to give some attention to the space in between our words. It's a negative space in a picture. It's the silence in a song that gives it beauty, but it's also focusing on these in-between moments. What is the moment between praise and blame? That it flips in the external world, we're famous, then we're canceled, or it flips internally. I feel good about this. Oh, now I'm going to self-sabotage. When does it make that swing? What is the in-between moment? In these eight winds, they're interdependent to blame. Right? That leads to shame. And that also calls then for more self-compassion and more self-forgiveness. Right? Praise. As I said before, that can really encourage arrogance or just always seeking more praise. We all know those people that are always looking for, you know, fishing for compliments, right? We're all guilty of it sometimes too, right? And yet that also, that arrogance, that sort of desperation, that can be balanced with gratitude. It can be balanced with appreciation for others, expressing that gratitude too. and we can savor joy and pleasure. There's nothing wrong with savoring those without getting too attached, trying to hold on to them, make them keep going, make the party keep going. We can also tolerate sorrow and pain all the better when we remember the wisdom of impermanence, and we remember too that we can't know joy without knowing sorrow. That these contrasts are how we perceive things as human beings. We can balance success and failure by taking more personal responsibility, but also not taking it so personally either. And so I want to get a little bit more deeply into each of these and think through a bit how they play out in our lives. So a bit deeper on fame and disrepute, or praise and blame. And I think how we approach and how we learn from praise and blame, these two, it really determines how resilient we often are in the world. And I think one of the best ways to deal with praise and blame is to be a little bit well-rounded, to have a number of different things, to encourage ourselves to do hard things that we're bad at, as well as just doing those things that we're good at because we know we get praise for them. It's important also to let ourselves make mistakes and try difficult things, and to think also, how do we spread our identity out? Because we are more than just our identity markers that we ascribe to ourselves or other people project onto us. We're more than in our culture, we're more than our job, we're more than our gender, we're more than our zip code. Even here in Cambridge, we're more than our degrees that we have, right? We're more than our likes and our dislikes on the social media algorithms. We're more than our biggest mistake. We're also more than our biggest success, more than our biggest pride. We're more than our biggest shame. We're more than all of these, and yet we also simultaneously holding all of this at once, we are all of them. Or does Buddhism also say maybe we're none of these? In fact, and yet being able to look at, to embody, to embrace all these facets that make us up, right? This also, in some ways, at the same time, when we embrace all of these, it helps us also see that we're none of these, and it helps us in some ways to embrace that idea of no self. The more we look at, oh, I'm so many of these things, and yet I'm also none of these at the same time. And so holding these identities lightly, I think, is important. And again, balancing things out like the ballast in the ship, evenly and widely. When we overattach to certain aspects of our identity, that's when we suffer, when the world doesn't give us that praise for it. Right? I'm the best student, I'm the best worker, the best husband, I'm the deepest meditator, right? I'm the first one to work, I'm the last one to leave, I'm the most loyal person at work. We get attached to that identity. I'm the most loyal person at CIMC. I'm always here early. I always leave late, right? At some point, there'll be someone else who gets to work earlier, leaves later, right? The world will tell you otherwise. They'll say, you know, no matter how much you meditate, no matter how much you get to work early and you work so hard, right? You're still not perfect. And yet also what we can know is that that's actually okay. That can be a bit of a relief. But that's why we melt down or we act out when we get news that we're not those things that we thought we were or that we tell ourselves we are, when we get too attached to those stories of our identity, or we give up on something just when it gets a little bit hard because it's new to us. We don't know what to do. And I think as good Dharma students, like we all hope we are, right? We get drawn to places where we feel good, right? Or we get it attached to that virtue stuff too, right? I am the best meditator. I do the most composting in my neighborhood. I am the most informed voter, right? We all get attached to that too, these identity markers. And yet actually, even those good values that we get attached to, they cause suffering too. I read this study a number of years ago that I cite sometimes, like, you know, one of the ways that we identify is through our bumper stickers that we have on our car, right? And Yet also, the more I read the study that the more bumper stickers you have on your car, actually, the more of an aggressive driver you are, because it's almost like you're attached. Like, this is my political identity. This is my spiritual identity. This is my sense of humor. All of these things, right? And then we become actually less compassionate because we get stuck on those aspects of our identity. We over-identify with self, right? That turns into pride sometimes, right? Right. And again, when these things, you know, we get too attached and the world tells us otherwise, we get anxious or depressed, we turn to drugs, we turn to distraction, we turn to depression, those things that land us in Dharma centers or land us in therapy. And so shifting our identity, broadening our identity, opening our identity, letting down some of these walls we build, this is what makes me, and so that's what makes me you. I define myself and my difference to you because this is how I vote, this is my bumper sticker, this is my this. And yet that keeps us actually from being more connected with others. So finding a balanced life for ourselves, a balanced set of identities, do things that you're good at, do things that you're not good at. Finding more balance helps us to be more resilient with these things. So that's some thought about praise and blame, and there's gain and loss. Inevitable parts of life from childhood onward, losing that refrigerator. Winning and losing streaks, they always end. We think we know that, right? But can we really accept the flow of victories and defeats? And can we also see that not every story has a silver lining, but can we look sometimes to see if there are silver linings? Or can we not assume that the story is over, right? Just in this moment of disappointment, just in this moment of loss, or just in this moment of gain and loss and success, gain and success in some ways. One of my favorite teaching stories is the one of Sai and the horse. Some of you might be familiar with this. Once there was a farmer named Sai who lived with his family on their small farm. And they were poor, but they had a horse who helped with the labor in the fields. And then one day, there's a storm. The thunder scared the horse, and the horse ran away. And the rest of the village came to console Sai on his bad luck. And he just replied, you know, good luck, bad luck, whoever really knows. And the following week, the horse came back. And this time had a mare in tow. And the villagers were like, hey, congratulations, Sai. Look at this. You've got the horse. You've got the mare. You're going to have more horses right before you know it. Right? Sai just says, oh, good luck, bad luck, you know, who knows. The next week, for the next month or whenever, they're, you know, training the new mare, and Sai's son is riding the horse and gets thrown from the horse, falling to the ground, breaks his leg. Villagers will say, oh my gosh, this is terrible. You know, your son broke his leg. This is the worst. And Sai just says, yeah, bad luck, good luck, who knows. You see where the story is going, right? But now, you know, the next chapter, war breaks out. You know, every young man in the village is recruited. Go off to the war, fight in the war, right? All the men in the village were killed. They were lost in the war, except for Sai's son. He stayed home. He had the broken leg, right? The villagers all say, oh my gosh, what a relief. He says, bad luck, good luck, whoever knows, right? This is the way our lives go, right? One door opens, another door closes, right? And those kind of cliches, but it's true. And if we look back on our lives, I think about this a lot in terms of how my life has landed where it is, which does feel like it's had a lot of success at this moment, right? But it's had a lot of failure and disappointment in other moments. Rejected from graduate school was my first idea for research many years ago, but then I got accepted the next year, and that kind of turned into, you know, getting a lot more interested in the science of mindfulness that leads me places like this, right? All these kinds of amazing things, all these people we've interacted with over time, right? That allow us to be who we are. So thinking about acceptance, you know, not writing the end of the story before it's really over, right? Thinking maybe there is more to this story. This isn't the end. This success point, this house, this mortgage, this job, this whatever, that's not the end of the story. And also neither is the lost the house, lost the family, lost the whatever. That's not the end of the story either. Right? There's always something more to the story, even if it's not ours, right? Someone else will continue to tell the story from the interactions we've had with them. But we can prepare ourselves for these more difficult times by working through, by seeing even day to day, just examining these smaller challenges, smaller setbacks, these little broken hearts, these little disappointments, right? I was late for work because of traffic, but I got to hear the cool story in NPR, and that got me thinking about this and that. And I'll turn this into a Dharma story that I'll share at CIMC, or this will go into a book that I write, or this will go into something else. We can keep finding lotuses growing in the muck. And we see how interdependent things are. We develop that equanimity when we can look into the future with that same acceptance, right, by examining, as I said, that winding path that got us where we are, right? That it was those times that we sometimes let go of control that maybe weren't always better than the times that we seized control, but sometimes they led to different outcomes that really were unexpectedly wonderful. Finding that balance, right, between taking risks, making mistakes, right, asking for help in our lives, doing the hard work ourselves, finding that balance, embracing all of it, not just either or, but all of it. So thinking through in our own lives, just reflecting, were there moments that the failure turned out to be a success or opened the opportunity for success? Were there moments also when something that seemed like a success was a mixed blessing? It was maybe more complicated, it was harder to deal with than we expected. I think it's just recognizing these, that no one thing is all good or all bad. So success and failure, right? Again, the dangers of success, these can be arrogance, they can be pride, right? Taking it personally, I did all this, right? I made this happen, right? And we forget to balance that out with the wisdom of gratitude, the wisdom of interdependence. And I think that with the successes we have in life, to not become arrogant, we really can balance those. The ballast for those, it can be mindful gratitude for others in our lives. I remember I had a mentor once, I can't remember what the success was that I felt like was so great. And he very gently also reminded me, remember when you feel proud about an accomplishment, also feel grateful to those who helped you. And I wish I could say it as well as he did, because it wasn't, you know, don't be so prideful, be more grateful, because I think some of us have heard that in that kind of tone as well. But it's not one or the other, it's both, right? I can feel a sense of pride in what I did, and yet I can also feel all that gratitude of all those people who helped me along the way. Right? There's so many. And it's important that we make space for thank yous from other people. We give them the chance to offer a thank you, that we make space to thank others. In our families, in our workplaces, we make space for thank yous. This is why Hollywood award shows, they're kind of, you know, famous for their never-ending acceptance thank you speeches, right? But this is why books have acknowledgments as well. So we can model that gratitude, we can practice that gratitude, we can think about those folks who helped us along the way, right? I think about, you know, the people that I just had an interesting conversation with 20 years ago that led me in this direction, right? Someone who seemed like a forgettable conversation, but maybe that actually did start to shift my mind toward this or open my heart in a little way. There's the big, obvious people that we all have in our lives, but there are those smaller folks, those smaller interactions, the study buddies, the class debate partners, the folks at work who gave us advice, welcomed us on the first day, those blessings at our wedding, those pieces of advice we got about relationships that did. Right? Imagine if we could say thank you to all those people, and we probably can't. Thank yous are endless. I vow to send all the thank you notes in the world. But to even just be grateful in ourselves as we just take the time to look back at those little interactions, right? Those folks who acknowledged us, those friends who were there, even those strangers who were there in moments of setbacks, moments of loss, and moments of of success as well. Thanking others and modeling, thanking others. I think a lot back to one of my first jobs was waiting tables, which is often kind of a thankless job. And one of the things I liked about working in restaurants was that there is a real culture in there of saying thank you. That when I was a waiter, I'd say thank you to the busboys, and I'd say thank you to the kitchen, and the kitchen would say thank you to us, and my manager would say thank you to me before I left for the day or for the night, before I got cut, you know, for the night going home. And it really did just help kind of lubricate the interactions and remind me, yeah, I'm not, you know, this food's not just showing up at the table, you know, the busboys are helping clear it, and the chefs are helping make it, and that they're thanking the, you know, the folks who then, you know, came in with the trucks from Cisco to bring it in, and the managers are thinking, right? It reminds us how interconnected that we all are. And that keeps us a little bit more balanced, keeps us right sized, keeps us a bit more humble, and prevents us from that arrogance that can start to happen. And setbacks, of course, are painful too. Failures, and yet they too hold powerful lessons for equanimity. It's easy to get fixated on what failures represent, right? And then the human brain, we have this negativity bias where we start to assume the worst, right? We see the negative more than we see the positive. The worse we feel, the worse we project things to be. And so it's harder to see that big picture, take the long view, right? So just being open to this, to watching this process as it unfolds. None of us is immune to success and failure, right? Even moment by moment, right? That's, again, I think what these practices are about, right? Mind wanders off, bring it back. What do I do with that? Do I tell myself I'm a terrible person, right? Because my mind wanders off, you're a bad meditator, right? Do I say, oh, you're the best meditator, you brought it back, right? No, it's somewhere in between. This is why practice itself is a microcosm for managing so many of these things. Do we react to our defeats with self-deprecation? Do we personalize defeats, right? Or do we acknowledge them and just go back to work? So reflecting too on these setbacks and disappointments, unconventional aspects of our own successes in life, who helped get us there, right? And can we share that with others too? Whoever we are, there's people that project onto us, right? Every mistake, every failure that you've had, that's entirely your fault. And also they say, you know, every success, like that person, like they made it all happen, right? It's always more complicated. It's always something in between all of these. So just trying to take a bit more of that perspective and share our mistakes with others in a way that's vulnerable. And also sharing our mistakes in a way that this is what I did for how I got through that mistake. Sharing our successes too. We can do that in ways that aren't arrogant. And here's what worked for me, right? It was counting on other people. This again keeps us a bit more balanced. It keeps us going and inspires others to keep going so that as we speak and act, right, the world becomes hopefully more balanced for others because we do all have wisdom that we can share. And yet we all need to fail, right? Learning is about failure, right? Adapting is about responding to failure. Resilience, right? These all require some degree of defeat. And not only is it okay to fail, right? But it's wise to fail, to try new things and learn. And learning to bounce back from failure is one of the most important things we can practice ourselves. It's through those smaller setbacks that we learn how to deal with the bigger ones. And again, when we fail, it's important that we not place the blame on others, other people, other circumstances, right? It was that mean boss. It was that, you know, jerk meter maid who wrote the ticket. It was that unfair, you know, professor who added in for me, right? Sometimes that's true. That's part of it, right? But sometimes it is also important that we look deeply and honestly at our own part if we want to learn, right? And if we want to not fall into the same traps, and if we want to create some new wisdom for others in this world to, again, alleviate suffering for the endless beings in this world. But it's finding that balance. It's holding all of that, right? The professor was a jerk and I could have worked harder, right? I kind of slacked off at work and my boss could have said that a little bit more nicely in terms of how they presented that to me. So finding that sense of agency, that internal locus of control, and also knowing that there are circumstances out of our control. What are these things that we can do, right? We can remember to feed the meter, right? We can play life by life's rules. We can live life on life's terms, right? Which are not always fair. They're not always how we want them to be, but we can still do our best and feel that we're living with integrity in doing what we can in the world. Joy and sorrow and pleasure and pain. And then I do want to make sure I get to questions and answers and discussion. Right, but we have survived. We've survived, the human species has survived for millennia. And the face of disease, starvation, violence, emotional pain of all kinds. Right? So many folks have experienced, especially in recent years, experienced trauma. And yet, actually, one of the things I discovered recently was that more folks who've experienced traumatic events go on to develop more wisdom, more growth, than just experiencing post-traumatic stress. And actually, both of these we experience often at the same time. But we can actually come through things stronger. We usually do. The norm is actually to come through things stronger. But what are the conditions under which this happens? And it is, I think, reflective practices. It's looking at what are the strengths we have. And questions like, right, when did I become stronger, right, when I overcame this certain challenge, right? How did I get through that difficult time? Right? What strengths do I rely on? What people do I rely on? Right? What wisdom do I rely on? What has helped me through different hard times? That can help us again in the moment through other ones, because again, these are inevitable too. So finding comfort, right, with change, with the unknown, with these wins, right? Success, blame, failure, pain, right? All of these. Equanimity is about appreciating, learning from, befriending change to see what wisdom can arise, what compassion can arise for ourselves as well as for others. Learning from everything and everyone that we meet in life, growing through all of it. To me, that's resilience. That's equanimity as well, right? It's the suffering that emerges, again, that when we start assuming that how it is now is how it will always be, right? With those losses, right? With those successes. And it's been this roller coaster these past few years that we've lived through in terms of this pandemic, in terms of politics, and then the way that also that manifests in our individual lives and the conflicts we have with family members and friends. Should we go out? Should we wear masks? Vaccinated, not vaccinated? You know, should we do this in the world for social justice? Should we do that? No, the world is fair. No, it's not fair, right? It manifests in these small ways in our relationships, right? All these bigger winds, these bigger torments and storms in the world. So getting comfortable with these changes, getting comfortable with the radical acceptance of not knowing, of not getting too attached to these stories, how it is now is how it will always be. No, how it is now is how it is now. Getting comfortable with and learning how to not take it so personally, not take the success so personally, not take the failure so personally, not take the pain so personally, not take the joy, the pleasure so personally, but also knowing that what we can do, what the Dharma teaches us is, to me, it's less about cause and effect. If I do this, this happens. But I hear about causes and conditions. If I create these conditions, this is likely to happen. If I create those conditions, then that is likely to happen. So how do I not control everything, but how do I just try to create more conditions under which I feel more equanimity, under which more wisdom, more compassion is cultivated in this world? And thinking through for each of ourselves, right, with these worldly winds, What's the balance for each of us? What's our balance? What helps us through each of these challenging, again, the pain, the sorrow, the success, the failure, the praise, the blame, all of these winds and what to each of us can help us through all of these, because life is suffering. There is suffering in this world. Change is the only constant, whether it's a real quote or a fake quote. And that we can't fix everybody else either, but that what we can do, if we want to create more wisdom and compassion in this world, is cultivate it in ourselves. And then it does start to ripple out in terms of how we speak and how we act. We then create the more just and wise and compassionate world that we hope to see. So thank you all very much. I spoke longer than I expected to, which always happens. But I appreciate your presence. And we've got about 10 or 15 minutes for questions or comments or other thoughts. I think there's folks online who are maybe have questions as well. And maybe folks in here, maybe nothing. But thank you for having me. And thank you for being here. Well, thank you all for your practice. Thank you those practicing at home. Thank you those practicing together in the hall. And may we all get, even if life doesn't get easier, as they say, may we all get better at living it. To me, that's what equanimity is about in a more kind of contemporary phrasing. But let's just take a moment and dedicate the merit of this practice that we bring more equanimity into the world, so that others may find more equanimity and we may feel more hope about humanity and our future and our present. Thank you and have an equanimous night, everybody.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.